This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Sandy Kearney, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 75, recorded Sunday, February 9th, 2014. Citizen Scientists.
And welcome to our podcast this evening, GamesAtWork.biz. Happy to be here with Michael Rowe tonight.
Hey, hey. Howdy, Sandy.
Snowy lands of Pennsylvania, Michael. It's snowing again. I don't know how many Mondays in a row we're going to face snow to get started, but I'm glad to be here tonight and looking forward to what we have to talk about.
Well, it's funny, we had our 2 inches of snow last week, I think it was, the same time that Atlanta had their total shutdown on 2 inches of snow because of bad time. It made sense. Everybody left at the same time, and the infrastructure's not designed.
We're used to that. You get to go in half a day of work and then they let y'all out at the same time and you get to fight your way home.
It's funny. We were talking, I was on a call for the day job, and we were talking to a guy up in the Chicago area, and we had schools closed on threat of snow. Then we had the schools closed, and then we had the schools closed for 2 more days due to cold. Right? So 4 days the schools were closed around here.
Right.
And in Chicago, the guy's like, yeah, we've got 2 feet of snow on the ground. It's snowing between 6 and 8 inches a day right now. We've yet to close school.
Yeah, the difference in being prepared or having equipment and not.
Exactly.
So in your neck of the woods, to have 2 inches, you might as well have a foot. Now, up here, really part of our big problem was, which was surprising, but we still had a lot of trees that had not been taken out by Hurricane Sandy that were just primed for these snowstorms. So the power outages became our problem last week, and it was very intermittent, and it was very bizarre, how it hit and where it hit. And, and a lot of people, we still have people without power up here now in some places. We were fortunate. We only lost it for 3 hours while they fixed a wire with a tree on it that had to be removed. But, I should have taken pictures, Michael. It was phenomenal to see, a foot of snow and then just see every tree looking like a snowy Christmas card. It was just phenomenal.
Yeah, that would have been great.
So here we are.
And what is...
meteorology should be a game.
It's a science game, right?
It is a science game. And with Doppler radar, it's less clear than ever. Now I not only have to manage meteorology, but I got to manage scenario management. And so I'm thinking that we should play some sort of fantasy game where everybody gets online and there's wagers for what will actually happen and how many actual inches. And
well, what they really should do is be honest about their data, right? Instead of saying there's a 20% chance of rain, which years and years ago when I first moved to Georgia, 20% chance of afternoon thunderstorms meant guaranteed afternoon thunderstorms, right? If it was 20% chance, it was going to happen. If it was 40 or higher, it may or may not. So why don't they talk about distributions, right? And say, our best models say there's somewhere between a 5 and 10% chance. But because of the outliers, it might actually happen, right?
Right.
And then you could play a game about it, right? And you could sit there and figure out, distribute everybody in an area, and everybody have their own little small weather stations, which have their own distribution of data, and you roll it up and kind of crowdsource the science to then have much more accurate stories of what should be going on.
Well, it is. And it's a great lead into one of tonight's topics, this citizen science, because if you look at the weather, like the Weather Channel and Wonderground and all these different places, they're literally using the citizen radar, the citizen weather station, whatever, depending on how much money a citizen is willing to put into their weather station, they are now using that and collecting that data in order to build their models. So, it's an amazing transformation from, what used to be really expensive weather radar. And I'm telling you, sometimes I get better radar readings from my local neighbors who are pumping that stuff into that citizen science portal. And in this case, it's Wonderground. And that's not cheap. That's the other thing I'm surprised about is these weather stations are not inexpensive. And yet
they're about a grand, right?
They're investing and they're serious about it. And, you know, they're willing to post and they have webcams. And, you know, so not only do I get the radar, but I can actually see the actual, you know, visibility. And it's a lot like it used to be when, you know, I was doing more of the flying stuff and you could see that. So it is happening and it's going on whether people, you know, are aware of it or not. This whole field of citizen science is just taking off. And of course, what I wanted to talk about on tonight's show was the citizen science gaming part. I've been working over this topic with my students in my emerging technology class, trying to get them to understand the open world concepts and how there's so much benefit in this. So last week we took a look at the game Foldit, and I went through, you know, what the value, and I had them tell me, and it's the same thing I would say to everyone that's listening, is what's the value of playing a game like Foldit? And, you know, when you begin to look at the opportunities to, you know, deal with human proteins and look at, you know, possibly literally creating a cure, you know, for a disease, chronic or otherwise, and, you know, or trauma or whatever it is, you know, brain injury, pick out whatever it is that we're working on. And I find that just phenomenal. And so I had them kind of go into this and we took a look at the game. And I think, Michael, you've played this game.
Yeah, I have. It's kind of interesting. Before we get deep into Foldit, though, I was going to talk ever so briefly about, you know, crowdsourcing of science data.
Right.
And a couple of years ago, was it 2 years ago or last year, I was at a conference and this one school system out in Hawaii was showcasing work that they were doing. They bring students from around the globe to this school with crowdsourcing of seismic data. And so you could, like, for $75, I think it was, any school could get one of these little seismographs and put it somewhere in the school, and they were building a real-time map of seismic activity on the global basis and being able to predict, like, tsunamis. They could identify where small events were occurring that weren't being picked up by, quote-unquote, real scientists. And we're doing some really cool modeling and other data driven analysis based off of all this seismic data. So the desire to participate in research in scientific effort of some sort, you know, gives rise, as the article talks about, the rise of citizen science, which I just think is awesome. But Foldit.
So do I. And I think it's different now. And so now we're taking, you know, when you combine this science via crowdsourcing and you combine it that, you know, as I always say, the engagement piece matters so much. So now when you fold that in and kind of combine the engagement piece with gaming, you know, I think the next generations, they just don't have the same inhibitions, if you will. They have a grander vision in some ways than others do. And I find that just simply amazing. I can remember the days, remember when you used to, you know, and it still goes on, I think, where you could donate your compute power to some collective science project, but that was so passive. And, you know, that's another thing I think that's so important about the serious part of our gaming that, you know, we have to think about as users is this engagement piece that, you know, how I engage is, it could make a difference because it can allow me, maybe I'm not someone who's on the early adopter curve. Maybe I'm in the majority and I don't, but my one small contribution, and this is what we talked about last week, was how your one small contribution and even playing the game and engaging might provoke someone who is an innovator and an early adopter to think of something or do something that could be literally life-changing.
Yeah, and the kind of the prime example of the passive one was SETI at Home, and you know, I was a big participant of that many years ago just because I liked it as a screensaver, and then, you know, I'm a space geek and et cetera, and so it kind of filled a need there. But then they changed the screensaver to a more generic platform that they're using. I don't do it anymore. But let's talk about Foldit. Because yep. That one's got a lot of press over the years for using gaming technology and gaming activities to do protein folding and allow scientists to get more accurate data and potential cures for diseases based off of understanding how certain proteins are folding. So I actually tried to play it some today in advance of the podcast. There's a version for Windows, there's a version for Mac, there's a version for Linux. So of course, you got all your major desktop platforms out there. They just released a new beta because they are using an underlying science engine called Rosetta that is specifically designed for protein design and structure prediction. And then they have added on top of it a set of game mechanics. And basically, it's a puzzle solver. And if you like to solve puzzles, it's perfect. And they actually do, like all kind of good learning games do, they let you start off with a set of very simple puzzles and learn the mechanics over time. And, you know, each tier of the tutorial adds, you know, more information of what you can do. So for example, let me just pull up the screen for a second and see if it destroys all activities as it relates to the network during this recording. I don't know if you heard the music that just kicked in. It may not be coming. Good, good. So you have to set up an account, password, etc., because it wants to track the data, right? And be able to actually go back to the user and let you rank and score and score yourself against others, etc. There are 32 intro puzzles.
Right.
And that's what I've been playing. I haven't gone into the science puzzle or the contests yet because they're not hard, but they're not easy either. So I've done all the what are called side chains. So in the protein folding structure, you have these. I'm going to describe it without using science.
Right.
Right. Because it's a game to me, right?
Well, right. And yeah. And then this you got is these, part, by the way. Part of what I challenged everyone last week when we were having this big discussion, because not only is it the citizen science as far as looking for some ultimate cure or problem solved, it's a huge education and learning opportunity all the while that you're making your way there. So I couldn't agree more, Michael. And that's what, you know, I have a group of students who are not in this space, you know, very few that are in healthcare or in biology or in those kinds of sciences. So for them, it was a huge learning curve just to even understand the very basic aspects. So all that you're talking about, it's phenomenal. So yeah, we're making our way through the game now to get to the point where we actually can contribute to the potential cure.
Right, right. And so you have the chains, and you start with side chains, which have like these little arms on the backbone of the protein, and where they conflict, there'll be what's called a clash, and there'll be like a little spinning graphic of a, you know, like a little star looking thing, and your goal is to move them around so those don't occur. And as you level up, you eventually get to shake. Well, shake, from reading the site, to me looks like one of the features that occurs within the more scientific tool, which actually is going to cause it to try to simulate some things to get to a point where it clears that problem. Then you do what's called backbone packing, which where you're actually looking at the gap between the parts of the protein. And again, you do some simple stuff and dealing with how they collide or how far the gap is. And then ultimately you get to wiggle, which again is a automated process that will try to fix things for you. And you think about that in regular game mechanics, that's like getting your superpower or your spell that your wizard gets in a game, or you know, that boss power that you need in order to defeat the boss at the end of the level. And then hydrogen bonding, that's the area I'm in. I'm on the last step of hydrogen bonding, where you're learning rebuild, where you actually can take and restructure part of the backbone and the layer where the little sticks are sticking out, right? Right. In order to make the protein fold correctly to achieve the maximum level. And you get points, and you have to hit a certain number of points in order to clear the level. And it's going to go much further than that, right? Electron density, going into things around sequencing, around protein right. designs, around DNA pairings, etc. And each of those levels in the 32 tutorial levels is designed to get you to have maybe just a little bit of scientific information now, or at least understanding the model of the science. You may not need to know the details behind the science, but if you understand the visual model, then you can leverage the value that humans bring into these games, which is the ability to quickly see patterns and to be able to react to those patterns and do things. And that's what's cool right. about this.
Right. Well, and I think the other really cool thing is bringing in the, quote, untrained eye, or the group that's not going to necessarily follow the educated rule. And so therefore, they're going to do things in a game that's going to cause something else. And, you know, to me, it kind of goes back to what Tapscott's had to say in his open world discussions about, you know, being able to share this information across in a collective environment today that then allows the, you know, the rules to be broken, if you will, right? Because we for so long now have used the industrial age models to go forward from them. And the reality of it is when we don't follow some of those rules, great things happen. And I think that's another thing that gaming overall in business and elsewhere has allowed us to do, is break the rules in a way that we would not have planned, because to plan to break the rules, you know, you still have a limited set outcome. You look right. at the MMORPGs today, right, in the non-business aspect, and you know, they're very, very scripted and canned, and therefore, and kind of sets us up now for this new open space, open yep. play, and what's that going to do in business when, you know, when the business rules are broken, what happens?
Right.
And that's why I think this whole, you know, citizen science is just one of the many dual structured or dual processed things that are out there now as a result of this, you know, being able to collect our wisdom and, you know, channel it through a game like this, and, you know, and have somebody who does understand it really well, then think differently about it, right? It prompts them to think differently.
Well, speaking of looking at the world differently, right? And using that as gameplay, and you're talking about MMORPGs. Well, imagine a game where the world you're playing in is this world accurately mapped down to, you know, unbelievable detail level for the entire globe. So the guys over at Reroll Game have just they just went out of their silent period. They're doing a campaign on their own site, so they're not using Kickstarter or Indiegogo or any other crowdsourcing mechanism that way. But they have this video out there that explains what they're doing, and I've actually signed up for an account. So I have an account on Reroll Game. I haven't bought any gameplay yet. But what they've done is they've taken the traditional kind of Halo or Doom or whatever your favorite first-person shooter game mechanic is, and they've started using a series of drones in the world, in the real world, to map the real world, to put this kind of dystopian future on, and they're going to build the maps based off of the pay-to-play model that they're doing, where you actually buy, you know, you might want to be a farmer, right? And so you buy a plot of land, and you buy a character for that plot of land, and they that will represent what it costs to map, you know, a 30-acre space of land on the Earth. And they're partnering with a company called Sensefly to actually use the drones to do all the mapping. And on their blog, there's an interesting discussion going on about, you know, which countries will actually allow them to map, right? So in the U.S., you can't do civilian drones yet. It's illegal, but it's supposed to be available by 2015. And there's all kinds of really cool stuff going on with this. What, Sandy, I know you had a chance to look at the video. What did you think of what the guys at Reroll are doing?
Well, I think it's really, really interesting. And, you know, we've talked about this, right, Michael, for a decade or more when we were talking about, you know, when we were heavily involved in the virtual worlds and saying, you know, at some point we're going to, the real world will be mapped into a cyber existence. And, you know, so not at all surprised. And it certainly reminds me of the things that our friend Eric Hansen has done out of USC, you know, several years ago when we did the virtual world standards event Sony Studios.
And
he brought to light, now what he was doing, of course, is using the static cameras, and they were using it, you know, mostly and primarily for scientific study, but you know, my guess is that, you know, he will love to see this Reroll work, and the Reroll guys will love to, you know, see what has already done. And the other part to me is when the Reroll guys figure out that a lot of stuff already exists, so they won't have to go and do absolutely everything, right? They can do, you know, start to piece together from the existing cyber mapping that's already been done in a, you know, really high def 3D, and it's out there. You know, that's going to probably pick up the pace for them as well. And this whole, you know, drone photography capture process, you know, that's going to have a huge discussion point around it. I know we talk about that regularly in my world of, we were looking at, by the way, Michael, last week, this drone that's a mosquito. Seen it, the mosquito drone. And so, you know, I think that folding all that into, again, a game that now has the open aspects that means a lot of unpredictable pieces. You know, and if you look at what the Reroll guys have said, this whole concept of, you know, it's kind of leveraging the cyber pet stuff from days of old, right? When your kids had to keep their cyber pets alive. And I keep thinking, that'll be interesting that I have to keep my cyber existence in the Reroll world alive, even when I'm not playing, right? So they've talked about time management in there already. And I mean, it's going to be phenomenal. And then what happens when, you know, businesses start up inside this space, which you and I both know they will.
Oh, absolutely.
Global Waters, I think about Richard Taylor and those guys from Global Waters who wanted to do the cyber underwater with, you know, the oceanography pieces to save the oceans. And, you know, so I can see the connections.
Blue, that was it. It was called Blue. I remember that. I used to run their screensaver.
Well, that was one of them. Blue was one of them. Global Waters was another. So Neville was the guy that we knew from Blue, and it's still up and running. And then Richard Taylor, a phenomenal guy and friend of ours, yep, is, you know, was doing the Global Waters work with the oceanography group. And, you know, again, I think that they would love to see this. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to see people want to not just participate buying the game to help them extend their business, but I think putting business inside the world that they've got, in whatever way, you know, whether you own all the quote, you know, I use it as an example, the Marriott signs or the, you know, whatever it is that you now are going to see in there, you know, you can get a lot of sponsorship, right? It's just like in movie sponsors. I can see great things happening with this. Now, what'll be interesting is if it's only, you know, if it becomes more like a first-person shooter type of game, or I know they said that it's not in their video, and I hope it's not, because, you know, survivalists aren't all necessarily aligned as first-person shooter type players. So we'll see what happens with, you know, with what they roll out and who actually buys into it, because I'm sure that will be the flavor that drives it.
Well, if you look at, so I looked at the game package, the shop of the game package, right? You see the types of survivalist characters that you can get and the stuff that comes with them.
Right.
It's a dystopian future, right? I mean, there's gonna be that level of gaming, of, you know, you've got to get assets, you've got to build up supplies, etc., to do stuff, right?
Right.
So the real question becomes, and I think this is the point that you were making, is on the in-game businesses, will there be an economy that stands up? right? Because, you know, if you look at one of the characters, so I'll just look at the first Aider, right? They come with, you know, first aid diploma, they get a shelter, a pistol, a med kit, a couple of enhanced mappings of the surrounding, and certain things like batteries. Well, in a survival world, batteries, I assume, are going to be really important. And if you're going to live off the land and somebody else wants to really have the comforts of home, they might be willing to trade something for those batteries and build up that economy.
Yeah, there will be that. And I got to tell you, my tip for these guys, honestly, would be to follow the Minecraft model, because I am watching that go on. And so why not have a creative mode? You know, why not have the survivalist mode? Why not make a mode that you can enter into, you know, and certain rules are off limits? And, you know, of course, you and I both know the server space that this is going to take is going to be huge. And, you know, I'm sure that's going to drive the cost and the business side of it. But the reality of it is there are so many things that I would highly recommend they need to, if they haven't already gone to study the Minecraft business model, go do it. Because those, that model is just, it's taking off. It's unbelievable.
Well, the thing that just is awesome to me is that SenseFly drone that they're using. I got the chance to talk to those guys at CES, because it's really, you know, they're part of Parrot, which is the company that makes the AR drone that I know a lot of our listeners have either played with or have seen, and we've talked about before in the past. But this is kind of their commercial for, you know, real world mapping, and this is cool stuff. And it's how much creation do you allow versus how much exploration? And, you know, we talked about, you know, a long time ago, both in our day job at the time and also on various podcasts, the different types of game mechanics, the different type of people, the people who like to explore, the people who like to create, and the people who like to, you know, run quests or do adventures, right? And how you have to really make a fulfilling game overall, you need kind of something for each of them to do stuff, right?
Right.
So.
Right. Well, oh, I love the SenseFly thing, Michael. And, you know, I think that there's so much to come that I have to tell you, again, this is sort of one of these, and I have to find the site, but I was reading up a few weeks ago about this revolution that's occurred where people weren't paying enough attention, and it's around the sensory activities. And you and I talked about that, you know, how many times and how many years of this whole sensory activity that's going on, and SenseFly is a part of that. And, you know, it's happened without people even being aware of it. It's evolving. And just now I feel like people are all of a sudden going, really? We've got that? And we can play that and we can do that. And, you know, it, and yet you and I both know this has been going on for more than 20 years.
Oh, yeah. And you look at, I mean, happening. I haven't picked up his latest book yet. But if you look at the, what was it? Kill Decision by Daniel Suarez, who also did, what were the first two books? Demon and Freedom Trademark, right? All the tech exists, right?
Right.
And Kill Decision was about drones, and the new one, I can't remember the name of it, but it just came out like this week. And this stuff's been around. And, you know, the insect spy drones that you talked about earlier, I mean, that stuff at some level exists, and the book just takes it a little bit further. But let's talk about something that might be much more closer to home for each of us, especially in this time of snow and then warmth and then snow and then warmth, which we keep, you know, going back and forth down here. And that is, you know, that must be playing havoc with people's home energy use. And Phaedra, who unfortunately could not make the show today, had sent out a link on Lockheed Martin's game that they're doing for reducing energy use in the home.
Right.
And, you know, I get it. I read the article. I looked through it. And, you know, all this stuff makes sense. But I'd really have to see what they're doing and see if it makes a lot of fun, because it's like, we have a complex problem, so we're going to give you a point for changing the light bulb, and then we're going to give you another point if you, you know, change your thermostat, and then you'll get more points if you watch a video. And I'm like, okay, this is, I don't mean to badmouth the idea because I love the idea. I think they really need to think about the different types of gaming mechanics and what the person gets out of it instead of just, hey, it'll be fun if you turn down that AC during the summer or during the winter.
Michael, yeah, and the real point here is, you know, Michelle Fox at the Department of Energy would certainly love to jump in on a discussion like this. You know, it's all about knowing who's playing the game, right? And yep. Clearly when I read this, I was like, oh, this is a game meant for the majority, the not even the early majority of innovators.
It's if you the look late at the majority. Innovation
cycle, right? This is the majority, and this is all like so simple. But again, what's missing? The motivation. So
right.
If you go to gaming mechanics and you go to gamification of anything, you know, engagement, mechanics, that all matters. And that's always an interesting topic for us even, right, is who's playing? Because this is not something that you're going to go to the laggards and say, hey, you know, change your light bulb. I'll give you a point. They're going to look at you and say, I'm a laggard. I don't change light bulbs.
Right. Right. And, I mean, I think the idea is great. And I think, I mean, when you look at what they're trying to get out of it, right, educating people on the best way to do energy stuff and reduce the carbon footprint. Good, admirable, love it. Get them to actually take action to make, you know, changes in their behavior. Great. And then the kind of the golden thing that they get out of this, if this thing becomes an engaging game and people play it, is the analytics that will then be able to be provided to, you know, government and industry game sponsors to understand what are the things that need to be done to improve energy use and to reduce carbon footprint, which things are working, which things are not working, and to game that mechanic so that you get real good, thought-out analytics to fine-tune the future changes that need to be made. But if it's just give me points and badges,
Yeah, well, that would be like me asking to do Foursquare in my own house. It's not going to happen. So, you know, and again, I would just submit to you that when you're doing all this stuff, you got to be looking at, you know, a laggard isn't playing games right now anyway. So,
right.
You know, who is it on this cycle that you are really going to get to play and do something? And I think for us and for our listeners, of course, what's so important is to say there are a lot of early majority. And, you know, as Simon Sinek would say in inspiring leaders discussions, is that you've got to get past the tipping point. And the tipping point really are, you know, the guys just past the innovators, the early adopters, and into the early majority. And it's not that hard to do, but you really got to know who it is that you're focusing on. And really, when you talk about games at work and gamification, that's what we need to focus on right now. We need to get to not the innovators, you and I, you know, I bought my Google Glass. I'm working on that. But, you know, it's really going to be the early adopters and the early majority that will drive a lot of this. And I see more people joining that group, by the way. And so I think, you know, Lockheed Martin, I applaud their efforts here, but I think what they really need to be thinking about is, you know, some realistic thing that can be applied to the early majority if they really want to think they're going to get the analytics out of it. And I think that's what, you know, our friends at DOE and training and in the innovation sector there, Michelle and those guys would say the same thing, is you're going to have to move up in that cycle in order to achieve the long-term goal or to get any volume of analytics to make it worthwhile. But I'll be intrigued and I'll be watching it to see, you know, where it goes next. And, you know, to see, you know, again, I would submit to you that after this week with all the grid problems and 2 years ago with the grid problems with, you know, the hurricanes, the fact that we can't in today's age reroute electricity without a pole and a wire says a lot. So my theory is let's have a grid game with energy and let's figure out how to rewire the grid and make it work. And let's throw that out to a bunch of kids that are playing Minecraft and doing other stuff that aren't going to think about the rules that we've currently got and see where we go from there. That would be my recommendation.
I think that's an awesome recommendation. Absolutely agree. And I know we're out of time for today. We really value your feedback, and I'd really ask that those of you who listen and subscribe through some kind of podcatcher, if you go to iTunes, if you subscribe that way, give us a rating on iTunes or post a post a review. We would appreciate that. It would give us better visibility in what you think, and it would also help our visibility so others could join in and provide more feedback, which then broadens the aperture of what we discuss about on the show. So we really appreciate your feedback, and we look forward to it.
We do, and for everybody, have a great week this week, and hopefully for those of us in the Northeast, it won't be another Monday, just another Monday snow day.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right. Bye. Great show. Thank you. Good night to everyone.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.